From the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, KUAR Public Radio brings you Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, the only program on radio today dedicated to the preservation of comparative generational thought, with your host, Phil Marriage. Welcome to the Crossroads of History.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another 2013 edition of Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow here in Little Rock. I'm Phil Marriage, your host. I'm really glad you guys can join us today. I want to mention the topic, but first I want to remind you, as we always do, if you'd like to listen to the longer version of our program, you can go to KUAR.org. Just click on the Programs button. We've changed a lot of things with the website, tying in with the NPR facility, so you have to go to KUAR.org, click on Programs, and slide all the way to the back page for Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, and that's where you'll find our podcasts and information on the program. If you had been driving down the road, though, let's say maybe 8 or 9 or 10 years ago, you would have looked at the license plate in front of you and it would have said, Arkansas, the land of opportunity. Well, it doesn't say that anymore. It says the natural state. So when that happened, when that changeover happened, I, like probably many of you, said, what happened to opportunity? Our topic today is opportunity, and there's a lot of different things we can say about that. It's a word that sounds kind of ethereal when you first mention it, like, what in the world can you talk about? But when you stop to really think about what opportunity means to you as an individual or to your generation, there's a lot of things to opportunity that we take for granted and we don't really think about. But that's what we want to talk about today from generational perspectives. My guest here in the studio with me is Dr. John Fawcett. He's Associate Professor of Psychology here at UALR, Clinical Industrial Organizational Psychology is what he serves in, and he's also a consultant for UAMS, COORS, the Arkansas State Police, and the Arkansas Department of Human Services. Additionally, he does a lot of program evaluations for AmeriCorps and the Neighborhood Leadership Program, and his specialty areas include personality and creative studies, religious affiliation, managerial styles, and sleep deprivation. And Dr. Fawcett has been on the program with us a few times over the years. Dr. Fawcett, glad to have you with us here again today.
It's very nice to be here with you.
And then joining us from Springfield, Illinois, from the University of Illinois, is Dr. Donald Morris. He's a CPA and professor of accountancy, and he has over 18 years of practice as a certified public accountant and extensive teaching experience. And for 10 years, he managed his own accounting practice there in the Chicagoland area, dealing with eclectic clientele of entrepreneurs. His teaching interests include the financial and tax accounting, as well as business ethics, and he's the author of the recently released book, Opportunity, Optimizing Life's Chances, which is available at Amazon.com. That's where I saw it. Dr. Donald Morris, glad to have you with us here today.
Thank you.
I do want to begin the discussion, I guess, from this very broad spectrum of thought about opportunity, but I do want to focus a little bit on where our generations are coming from. Dr. Morris, I'd like to begin with you. If you can give us just a little bit of a broad view of what your book deals with. In actuality, I wasn't able to find too many sources that really focused in on the word opportunity, and I was really glad to see your book and from what you sent to me, a lot of different things that you were thinking about the word opportunity you could share with us.
Sure. First of all, when I wrote the book, I didn't set out to write a book. I just was curious personally about people I knew and my children and so forth, why it seemed like some people would see an opportunity, what I took to be an opportunity, and recognize it and act on it. And other people seemed oblivious to things that I thought they should react to. And I was just curious about that. So I started in my mind just thinking about what the elements or characteristics of an opportunity are, and I gradually pieced together several things that I thought were central to an opportunity. And then to flesh that out, what I did, and this is what most of the book is I looked at different areas where opportunity is important, and I did research into each of those areas. For example, in law, you know, we know that elements of a crime include opportunity and motive and so forth. And then in marketing, there's always concern about opportunity. Economics deals with opportunity cost and so forth. So I looked at different areas that involve opportunity, and then I also tried to look at different areas where there seemed to be a lack of opportunity. For example, I did some reading on poverty, you know, to see what it is about poverty that seems to preclude opportunity, and tried to put together a whole picture. Like you said, I didn't see anything else out there that treated the whole topic from all different angles, and that's what I tried to do.
Let's talk about like the older time frame compared to where we are in our middle or our younger. See, what do you think about the older generation perspective of opportunity as they saw it? Like, let's say even before World War II.
One thing, if I can go back a little bit further than that, just because I mentioned this in the book, is if you go back 100 years before that or so, the worldview of many people, I mean, especially in Europe and so forth, was if you were born the son of a tailor, you were going to be a tailor and that kind of thing. So I think that prevailed for most of history, that people didn't look at opportunity the way I think we do now. There was a pecking order hierarchy, you know, and if that's where you were, that's where you belonged. And there was a famous book called The Great Chain of Being that explained the whole history of that. And as far as before World War II, I'm sure during the Depression, it was a very interesting topic for people that thought about it.
The economy we've been living through, all of us have been living through in the last number of years, mm-hmm. opportunity seems to possibly have had a brick wall in front of, for a lot of us anywhere. Dr. Fawcett, any thoughts on where you might have seen that in this current time frame?
When you're talking about opportunity, to some extent, you're talking about change, and with change, there are opportunities, there are also risks. And with the change that you would have with opportunity and risk, you'd have stress involved. It produces stress, big changes. So the economic environment we've had over the last few years has brought about many challenges for people, to some extent, some opportunities. And sometimes people are forced to take advantage of opportunities or strive to take advantage of opportunities they might not have taken risks on previously. Like maybe they were in a situation where they'd had a job that was fairly stable, and then they end up losing that job, and they have to maybe try some things they hadn't tried before.
You kind of mentioned something there that I think the three of us would be interested in. When you lose the job, mm-hmm. is that an opportunity, or what? What's going on there? Dr. Morris, any thoughts on that at all?
The way I framed that in my book is I would say losing a job is a catalyst. And then the catalyst prompts the person to realize there's a problem, and then to try to look for different solutions to the problem. And the different solutions might be changing careers and whatever it is. But I would think that that's definitely just a catalyst for action, and different people are going to react differently to it.
Let's keep on along the same line of thought here. Let's pretend like you're a young person, you're in your 20s, or you're in your 40s, or you're in your 60s, and this economy hits the way it does, and you see an opportunity. Do you handle it a little differently from your age perspective? If you were a young person and you saw the opportunity, would you be willing to go into it? If you're an older person, would you say, maybe I'll pass?
Well, from my perspective, I would think, I know I took many more risks than I would take now. For example, when I was a practicing accountant, at one point I started my own business, and I started from scratch with very little money and resources and so forth. And looking back on it, I'm kind of amazed that I have the nerve to do that, and I'm sure I wouldn't now. So, yeah, I think there's an element of cautiousness that creeps in as I got older.
Now, you said you wouldn't do it now. Right at that word of now, where were you at the age where now would become a stopping word for an opportunity?
I was about 40 at the time. At that point, I saw it as a risky proposition and so forth, but I saw it as something that was worth the risk, or potentially was worth the risk, because the job I had at the time was I was working as an accountant. It was a secure job and so forth, but it wasn't really leading anywhere, and it was getting a little, not dull, but routine. So I saw the prospect of starting a business as kind of an adventure and a way to reinvigorate myself.
I think maybe taking a chance on an opportunity and the risks involved, partly determined by one's perception of the responsibilities that they have. And maybe when you're quite young and you're, say, unmarried and don't have children, if you fail, if you take a chance and it doesn't work out for you, you only are responsible for yourself. Once you get married, have kids, and all that, they're relying on you too. And so you may feel like you have to stick with a job you're not happy with, or you don't feel like there's much advancement or anything. But maybe then again, when you reach around age 40 and your kids are getting older, or maybe grown and leaving the house, maybe you feel again that you have a possibility that you can take a few more risks. Maybe you may be a little more established financially and positioned to do that kind of thing.
If job A comes up to you when you're 20 or you're 40 or you're 60, I guess I hear both of you saying that you would define job A differently. So that is the opportunity different, or is it the person as they perceive it different from an age standpoint? Any thoughts on that, Dr. Morse?
And one thing I try to make a point in my book is that many people use opportunity when I think they should just be using option. So if you had three jobs, those are the options. And none of them may be opportunities, or all three of them may be opportunities. So the perception that it's an opportunity is the perception that it's a solution for that person. So I look at it at a very personal level. So one person sizes up this particular job as a solution to their problem. And it may be a job that nobody else would want, or that everybody else would relish. But it's the idea that at a younger age, for example, I was looking for a complete change, and my kids were getting older, and I had just gotten divorced and so forth, and it was more like, well, you know, what have I got to lose?
Why not?
So, head on out into the wild. Well, so
somewhat similar experience around the same age, and it came about after I had I'd been divorced and recently remarried, and my original degree is in industrial organizational psychology, and had toyed with the idea over the years of pursuing clinical psychology. But then when I got remarried and was in my 40s, I started thinking, well, if I am going to take advantage of that opportunity, I need to do it now. And so
Time was one of the factors.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I hear a skirting around a little bit of when we talk about opportunity at these various time frames, that there has to be some emotions involved. So I'm wondering about, do we look at opportunity from an emotional standpoint? If we are sad, do we act one way? If we're mad, do we act one way? Glad or scared, do we act because of our emotional attitudes at opportunities?
Emotional aspects in terms of risk is a generational thing. I've thought about that quite a
That's
bit.
That's like fear. Are you afraid to jump?
Yes. I think part of it has to do with the socialization process that's going on at a particular time in our history of what's going on economically and in terms of politics and what during a sensitive period, maybe through adolescence, early adulthood. For instance, like with Generation X, you know, people born, say, between 1965 and about 1980, they had kind of an unusual experience in that when they were teenagers, they experienced the kind of the downturn, that last one that came about in the very late 80s and things like that. It was a period of time when, you know, you'd had that when they were little kids, the Iranian hostage crisis, and maybe, you know, hearing about Vietnam was recently over and first war we'd lost. And there was this view that we were no longer the most powerful nation on earth, that we were no longer the strongest economy in the, you know, 80s. They were talking about the Japan for a time was some thought richer than we were. And they were getting this message that this would be the first generation that did not have it as good as their parents did, and that there weren't going to be these jobs, and you couldn't count on companies hiring you and keeping you for life again. And so the idea was that these people had this feeling that why worry about these careers and whatnot, and that term slackers came about, where, you know, you were just kind of living for the moment and not so career-oriented. And then something strange happened in a way, in that in the 90s, the economy boomed. They had a lot of jobs, and a fairly few, a small group of people in the Generation Xers who were young at that time would take the jobs. So they had many more opportunities than they had been told they would have or expected to have. I think that has molded that group to quite an extent in terms of their perspective.
I think that's a very a good analysis of how a generation can grow up and be molded by the economic forces around it. And I think if you go back through history, you can see that also. For example, people that I've known that grew up during the Depression in the 30s, they look at the money and they look at things very differently than I certainly did. And the first time I ran across that, it seemed very odd. But now, in retrospect, having lived through our own financial crisis now, we can see that, those external circumstances that we have no control over, basically, can really put a damper on how you think about things.
Well, since both of you guys are involved in on college-level age group of people, when you look at their faces and you see what they are doing in their lives in terms of opportunity, what do you see? Dr. Morris?
I see some of the same things that prompted me to write the book, is how some of them seem to get it and understand what their role is as a student and why they're studying and what, you know, they may have plans. Their plans may change, but at least they're thinking about what they're doing in a systematic way. Then I have other students that seem to be just stumbling along and don't really know why they're here and might better be served doing something else. So it's that part of it probably doesn't change from generation to generation.
I remember those days myself.
Yes. I think, and as looking at the students, it seemed that there'd be as a growing gap in our society, not only an income gap, but there seems to be a growing gap in terms of preparation and in terms of opportunities like that you would have in school to, you know, get to good schools with good programs and that kind of thing. And it's almost like that we have some students that have had fewer opportunities in the past, and they're struggling to figure out where they fit in and are they prepared for the careers they'd like to go into and that kind of thing. I see another group of students who maybe, you know, were fairly privileged growing up and were in private schools or advanced placement classes in public schools and had a lot of opportunities, and they seem to be almost a lot of times overwhelmed by their opportunities. It's like they have too many possibilities, and it's causing them a great deal of anxiety, a lot of expectations. You know, we've handed you everything, we've given you the best of everything, and now you've got to come through and prove yourself, and it seems to be cause a lot of stress.
You're taking me to the question that becomes obvious, that the difference between a good opportunity and a bad opportunity, as defined by our generations, as defined by our society. Dr. Morris, what's the difference between a good opportunity and a bad opportunity?
I don't really accept the question like that, because if an opportunity is supposed to be the solution to a problem, yeah, you can pick a better solution or a worse solution, but I wouldn't categorize it as a good opportunity or a bad opportunity. At the time you're choosing it, you think you're choosing the better alternative, even if it doesn't turn out well. If you look back on why you made that decision, and if you made it for what seems still like legitimate reasons and so forth, the fact that it turned out badly, to me, doesn't make it a bad opportunity. It just means one that didn't pan out.
So a bad opportunity is really just the ones that your folks tell you about. Right.
Or even the perception of whether the opportunity, whether it panned out or not. You know, in some ways it may have been a very successful move. Say you decide to start your own business and you look at it, you know, 5, 6 years, 10 years down the road, and you're making twice as much as you were before. So from that perspective, it was a good decision. On the other hand, you look at it and you're working twice as many hours as you were before and seeing your family less often, and you're experiencing a lot more stress. So from that perspective, maybe it didn't work out as well as you might hope. And of course, you don't have any real way to judge those decisions you didn't make, the roads not taken, you know, how those would have panned out, you know.
The one thing I would add to that I try to bring out in this book too is that I think of opportunity, and again, this is at a very personal level, but as having an ethical dimension to it, in the sense that when you're choosing an opportunity, you're also choosing who you're going to become, and so you're trying to choose a better life for yourself, or you're trying to become a different or a better person than you were at the time that you made the choice. So for that reason, again, it makes it hard to say it was a bad opportunity, because if you were doing it for the right reasons, then that makes every opportunity in that sense not neither good nor bad, but it works out or it doesn't work out.
Another aspect of this discussion that I'd have to take, I need to really bring into it, is a word that we've heard a lot about over the last, say, 20 or 30 years, and that's equal opportunity. Mm-hmm. And how that plays into our generational perspective. Dr. Morris, let's start with you. How does the word equal opportunity play out over time?
I think when I first started hearing about it, it was in respect to equalizing in terms of maybe quotas or something like that in the job, in the context of jobs or in the context of entrance into schools, medical schools, and so forth, that every segment of the society needed to be represented in terms of specific numbers and quotas. And that lasted for a while, and then I think that has kind of tapered off. And now I think the idea has just become more generalized into the way many people think that grew up during that time. So that it doesn't seem like the need for quotas exists anymore. I mean, that's my perception.
You know, there was a lot of talk about equal opportunity between men and women, in some sense, you know, women do have a lot more opportunities today. Of course, many more women are getting professional degrees. And in fact, I think there are more women in a lot of those professional programs today than there are men. So that's changing. So, you know, a lot more opportunity there. You know, still some concerns over whether, you know, equal pay and that kind of thing, but are more opportunities. But at the same time, there's a lot of stress that comes with that. For instance, the stress in terms of roles that, say, you're a woman and you're pursuing a career outside the home. What kind of pressures does that put on you in terms of the choices and the opportunities you have in terms of raising your kids in the home and taking care of them? I mean, a lot of women feel stressed about to what extent they should play one role or the other.
Has that aspect changed from the older, middle, and younger time? Do older women see that stress more pronounced than, say, middle-aged women or even younger women?
Older women around today, of course, they didn't perceive that they had the kind of opportunities outside the home that women today feel they have. And so they may had more of those who felt trapped in the home, for instance, who, you know, desired to be working outside the home. And they didn't think there were many opportunities available to them. Then, I guess, really starting in the 60s and through the 70s, there was this movement to, you know, for the women's liberation movement and that type of thing. And more opportunities opened up. And I think maybe a funny thing happened at that time in that there was the perception among some that if you were a woman who chose to stay at home and, you know, exert most of your energy raising the kid, that sometime you were not taking advantage of opportunities that you should take advantage of, that was, you know, not a very valuable choice or whatever. Nowadays, I think you got a much more complicated situation where you have women who are pursuing professional careers and are quite happy to do that, and that's what they want to be doing. You also have women who are working outside the home who might rather actually be working in the home, you know, and just like there's some men who are working who probably just as soon not be, you know, mm-hmm. not enjoying it. And then you still have women maybe who have small kids or something who would like to be working outside the home but feel for one reason or another that they need to stick around the home and would like to. And then you have women who are perfectly happy with being in the home, and that's where they want to be.
One aspect of that I've run across that's interesting, that's a part of that whole picture, is the perception of marriage and the fact that over the last 50 years, I've seen the numbers, and I think it was between 80 and 90% of people either were married at some time or aspire to be married and so forth 50 years ago, whereas now it's down to under 50% of mm-hmm. people. So the value of marriage, in some sense, has diminished, and that may be a reflection of the fact that people are seeing more choices and seeing that some choices maybe go with marriage better than other mm-hmm. choices, and some career choices, maybe marriage is taking a back seat to those career choices.
In terms of the opportunities for men and women, I think there's a perception that men do not have the same opportunities to be within the home as the primary child rear or whatnot. You hear more and more men doing that, where the wife is the primary breadwinner and the man is taking care of the home and taking care of the kids primarily. There's a stigma a lot of times in our society attached to that. And
do you think that's because women took advantage of opportunities in the years gone by that they've now achieved to the point where that equal is not quite so equal anymore, that in that they are earning more?
I think they're, on average, they're better students. and I don't know if they're actually earning more on average now than men, but I think you're seeing a trend towards that. And I think it's going to cause some opportunities, also some stressors in our society here in the next 20, 30 years.
Well, Dr. Morse, you're in another region of our country in the Midwest, or the upper, I guess you'd say the Midwest, upper Midwest. Do you see things differently regionally that way too, in terms of the men and women and opportunities?
I was originally from Chicago, and I think it's quite a bit different in a big city than it is where I am now, as a lot of our students are, you know, drawn from small rural communities and so forth. So I think the pace of change is quite slow here. It's hard to see the changes as much, but in my students, I also see the women being more practically oriented in their career choices and the men having a freer picture of what they might become in the future. If I could just give one example that I always chuckle about is I had a very good, bright guy in one of my accounting classes, but he never did very well on the test compared to what I thought he could do. And I finally talked to him about it. I said, what are your plans there? And he said, well, I'd like to be a race car driver, and accounting is plan B. So, I don't run across a lot of women that would take that perspective, you know, but maybe that's just my, you know, limited experience.
So why doesn't he pursue his opportunity to be a race car driver?
Oh, he is. I just think he's still doing that, but he just thinks that the chances of making the big time are much more limited than they are having a stable career in accounting.
So he's kind of given a pecking order to the probabilities of success with different opportunities.
I think that's right.
I kind of perceive that to be the case as well. It seems that a lot of the young men are kind of floating. I see a number of young men in my clinical practice, you know, in late adolescence, early adulthood, and they seem to have their vision of where they're going is less clear than with a lot of the women I've talked to in the same age group. Yeah.
When I reflect on my own experience, I was the same way. When I was in college, I had no idea what I would do. And so I majored in philosophy.
I did too.
So did I.
Maybe that's the difference. Maybe the men haven't changed.
We have three philosophy majors here, huh?
Maybe it's just the women have come along now and they know what they're doing.
When I was, a sophomore or junior in college, it was time to declare, you know, what I was going to do. Mm-hmm. And I was wandering around, just like you guys have mentioned here, and I thought, what is the only thing that I really want? Am interested in doing, and that was what I thought was the career or the elements of a degree in philosophy were. So I said, that's what I want to do. But I didn't have an opportunity attached to it so much as I did a desire just to go into that study.
Yeah I had four different majors in college.
How about you, Dr. Morse?
that's what it was for me. I said, well, I don't know what I'm going to do, so I'll enjoy the time I'm here.
Yeah, that's right.
I think it was a great decision.
Yeah.
Well, let me take the discussion into another area here having to do with the financial aspects of where you're born in. And I think you alluded to that in the very beginning there, Dr. Morse. If you're born into a wealthy family or if you're born into a family that is maybe an immigrant family or something like that, you're really at the bottom rung. How does the financial aspects of your family fit into opportunities?
Well, I think it plays a huge role in the sense that, again, if we go back to the opportunities as considered as options, if you're growing up with some money and some financial backing, the options are many times more than if you're growing, you know, if you're from an immigrant family or you're growing up in a less well-to-do family. When you look at your options, you automatically rule out a number of things because they're going to take money to go there. Maybe going to medical school or something. And also the people around you. It always bothers me when people say, oh, you don't want to do that because there's no jobs or you'll never make any money. I think you get that kind of discouragement in a less affluent environment also, whereas in a more affluent environment, you're probably more apt to be encouraged to do most anything because the money is not an issue.
I think that definitely the people from lower socioeconomic groups perceive that there's a lot less opportunity in our society than people in the higher socioeconomic groups. Then the people in the higher socioeconomic groups perceive the people in the lower socioeconomic groups to be. I think people in higher income levels and have had more privilege maybe tend to view there being many more opportunities for people across the spectrum of society than the people actually living in poverty and whatnot.
Dr. Foster, let me ask you about one of the other aspects about opportunities as we see it from a perspective of a liberal or a conservative. We hear so much about politics today in the pro-positive or negative liberal versus conservative. How does that fit into opportunity?
Well, I think there is a widening gap in the perspectives between those who would view themselves as conservatives and those who would view themselves as liberals within our society. I think in general, conservatives view there being many more opportunities available to everyone across different segments of society than people who have a more liberal view. From the more liberal side of things, see more constraints in terms of less opportunity, particularly the people in our society who have not traditionally had the opportunities, like minorities and women and you know, new immigrants to our country, that it's not, in their perspective, it's not a level playing field, that the same opportunities are not there. Well, I think people from a more conservative in their viewpoint, it's they don't understand that. To them, it looks as if there's great opportunities out there for everyone, and anyone who wants to exert the effort can succeed, you know, in our society. And I think those are two worldviews that are quite different and color a great deal about people's politics and what's happening. And
you mentioned, to digress a little bit, but to add to what you're saying there, you mentioned a little earlier at the end of World War II that the GIs had more opportunities then. So my question is, in fitting into what you're saying there, how much did that particular bill or that law of the GI Bill change society in terms of opportunity? From a liberal and conservative standpoint, like you're just talking about.
I think in a massive way, really. What's often thought about, I think, as being this period of time in our country where you had these strong economy, strong families, this kind of middle class work ethic and middle class opportunities where people are living in the suburbs with a nice home, and you could have a family where only one of the partners are working outside the home, the other one's able to work in the home and take care of the kids, and all that was really true of our society for some people only for a fairly brief amount of time. And it was really, I think, for those people who came out of World War II, were allowed an opportunity that past generations had not gotten, to actually go to college, because mostly it was wealthy people who were able to go to college before that, who could actually afford housing, decent housing, because of the veterans loans. And you had a group who could actually live that American dream in relatively large numbers. Before that, you didn't have that. You know, men, women, children working like, you know, dogs, you know, 14, 15, 18 hours a day in factories, little children crawling around in, you know, machinery, and or working on the farm, everybody working very, very hard. And nowadays, if you look at it, how many families are able to live that lifestyle? Well, you have the nuclear family where mom's staying at home taking care of the kids, and dad's out there, you know, working and making enough money to you know, support the family. You know, that opportunity for most people doesn't exist. It's very difficult for a family to make it without both adult partners out there. I would think that from the liberal perspective, that people would talk about that the unions are no longer as strong, and the period of time that was best for most people was the period of time in the 60s and 70s where the unions were strong. And people had job security, and they, you know, people working in labor positions were actually making enough money to support a family. Now you look at it, they would say that, look at like people working in retail today, or you know, fast food, or different kind of labor positions where they're not even getting 40 hours a week. They would say, you know, you don't have health care, you don't have money, and you actually have the working poor, people working basically full time and still on the food stamps or whatever. So their perception is, I would think, that things have gone backwards and not in a good way.
So the opportunities are in a column that they can't access.
Yes, where I imagine from the more, you know, conservative standpoint, that the individual freedom comes with some risk, but it's that freedom that allows for individual opportunity to achieve as much as, it's unlimited in a sense what they can achieve. And so it's really up to the individual.
Let me throw the word challenge into what we're just now talking about. That I've heard many different people say that they come from a well-to-do situation, that they have too many choices, and I think you mentioned that earlier, Dr. Fawcett, whereas a younger person, maybe in a not-so-well-to-do family, is challenged by, I need to pull my bootstraps up here and really do something here with my opportunities. Do you guys see that as being a factor in our generational perspectives over time?
I think the challenge factor, it's a very personal thing. I mean, I think some people can see the challenge and see that as something to build off of, but I think a lot of people can get discouraged and feel a sense of helplessness and use that as a reason not to try to do anything.
When we're in the you know, situation that we're in a society where we're in, we may not perceive all the opportunities that are out there that someone, like say, coming in from outside our society, from another culture or something, from another country, immigrating in, may see opportunities that the rest of us just fail to see. An example of that, I remember I was in graduate school in New Orleans in the 80s and had some Vietnamese boat people come in, you know, with absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. There were a lot of concern among the people living in New Orleans at the time that there were going to be a burden on the city. But you started to see the most interesting things. You started to see a lot of these people like working on the side of the road, doing jobs nobody else wanted. And they started fishing in the Gulf using little 14-foot John boats instead of the shrimping boats. And I was out doing a project with the police there, and we went to this domestic disturbance at one point at this little rundown apartment complex. And the police, we got through talking to the couple there, and the police said, I want to show you something. And it was this right down on the by the river. There was a levee there. And they took me over the levee, and it the entire, all the ground that was not owned by really anyone, I guess, between the levee and the river was cultivated. All the people from around there that were the Vietnamese people had moved into this housing project were farming that land and, you know, and selling the vegetables and whatnot. So they saw an opportunity that a lot of us, you know, wouldn't have thought about, you know.
The only thing I wanted to mention was in this book, what I try to do is just bring a framework together so somebody could think about. I mean, some people, I think they think they missed an opportunity when it wasn't really an opportunity. And if they had a better picture of what constitutes an opportunity, they might not beat themselves up as much. And the few elements that several of them I mentioned is just the idea that an option is not necessarily an opportunity. And I think marketing tries to present opportunities very often as if they were commodities, that here's an opportunity for everybody. But I think it's a much more personal choice than that. And that's one of the things I try to get across in the book.
It occurred to me when Dr. Morris was talking earlier, and I agree with him, that the generations, say pre-World War II generations, you know, they grew up on a farm and it was kind of expected that they would continue on the farm. They work in a factory and that their father had worked in it, and there was not much opportunity to change. But since World War II, maybe with the soldiers from World War II having the opportunities with the GI Bill to, you know, go to college and get affordable housing that they hadn't been able to get in the past, that opened up some new opportunities. Another thing that happened then, starting in the 80s and then on, was this idea that you couldn't really rely on a company to keep you as employee across your lifespan, and people were living longer. So basically, I'd say with like the, particularly with the baby boom generation and those since, there was a feeling that you did have the opportunity to pursue more than one career. With that came, I think, some stress, and maybe that tied into what was called, you know, the midlife crisis. It's basically like a time where you reflect and you decide if you want to stick with what you've got or if you need to make some major changes in your life. And so it offers the opportunity to have a number of years where you can pursue another career or a different life almost altogether. But also with that, again, comes a great stress. What if you make the wrong decision? What if you fail? What if this? What if that? You know?
Well, folks, as you've been listening to the program here today, I'm sure we didn't help you at all make a decision of what to do with one of your opportunities. But I hope if our discussion here today that you've had a chance to maybe dwell a little bit more on what opportunity might mean for you in your particular life. I do want to thank my guests for being with me here today on the program. That last voice you heard was Dr. John Fawcett. He's been in the studio with me here. He's an associate professor of psychology here at UALR. Dr. Fawcett, thanks so much for being with me again here today.
Thank you for having me.
And then that voice you heard coming from the phone is Dr. Donald Morris. He's joining us from Springfield, Illinois. He's a professor up there, and he wrote a book called Opportunity, Optimizing Life Chances, which I mentioned is on Amazon.com. And I will say this about the book, Dr. Morris, you were good enough to send me 33 pages of it, which I was able to read. And I also read the comments that people did about your book. And I can say this, that there were several comments made about the book, and all of them were very, very strikingly positive about all the things you had to say about the book. So if you're a person listening to the program today and you're looking at opportunities and you want to get kind of in depth with it a little bit more, if you forget the name of it, go to our website at KUALR.com. KUAR.org, and I'll have a link there to the book, Opportunity Optimizing Life's Chances. Dr. Morse, thanks so much for being with us here today.
Thank you, Phil. I enjoyed it.
Folks, thanks for listening this evening. We'll see you next week. Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow is a production of KUAR Public Radio, Little Rock.